Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Nobel Prize-winning economist Angus Deaton, co-author of Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism, and author most recently of Economics in America, An Immigrant Economist Explores the Land of Inequality. And you can learn more at Deaton, D-E-A-T-O-N, .scholar.princeton.com. .edu. I'll say that one more time, deaton.scholar.princeton.edu. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, Terrence McNally, all one word, .net. Today's guest, Angus Deaton, won the Nobel Prize in Economics for work accomplished before he and fellow economist Ann Deaton's wife, Ann Case, wrote the best-selling book that introduced the notion of deaths of despair as an explanation for their shocking realization that life expectancy in the U.S. was falling, due in large part to alcoholism, drug overdoses, and suicides. They named something that I think many of us kind of felt was happening. Not the falling life expectancy necessarily, but the desperation, alienation, and self-destruction at its root. And due to the power of their revelation and their explanation, I assume at least outside of economic circles that this dark and alarming phrase is now what Angus Deaton is best known for. Deaton's latest book, Economics in America, repurposes reflections expressed over the last 25 years in regular bulletins he has written for Britain's Royal Economic Society. He's updated the original material, reframed the insights from the viewpoint of the end of 2022, and added a great deal that is new. He tackles specific issues, highlighting, for example, inequality in healthcare, and looks at the broader field of economics. One of the last two chapters is actually titled, Did Economists Break the Economy? And as I was preparing for this conversation, I began to feel that his choice of revisiting material from a quarter century and undertaking not the deep examination of just one issue or even one trend, but more the larger interplay of economics, politics, culture, and society invited me to do the same. So I'm going to treat this next hour as an opportunity to ask big questions about where we stand, how we got here, and our best path forward from a situation that feels perilous in terms of social cohesion, economic fairness, and democracy. Angus Deaton, winner of the 2015 Nobel Prize in Economics, is the Dwight D. Eisenhower Professor of Economics and International Affairs Emeritus at Princeton University. He's the author, as I said, with Ann Case, of the best-selling Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism, and author of five other books, including The Great Escape, Health, Wealth, and the Origins of Inequality, and his latest, Economics in America, An Immigrant Economist Explores the Land of Inequality. Welcome, Angus Deaton, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, February 13th. Now, first of all, I'd like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about here. So can you tell us in your own words a bit about how you see your path to the life you've led and the work you do, and feel free to go way back, mention childhood inspirations, mentors, turning points, that sort of thing.
Well, I see much of it as a chapter of accidents. It certainly wasn't planned, even quite late on. So that, you know, I was born in Scotland on the very end of World War II. My dad had started life as a coal miner and was invalided out of the army with tuberculosis, which enabled him to get a much better job than he otherwise would have gotten. And he strove very hard and very successfully to get me a very good education. So I actually finished up at Cambridge. At Cambridge, I was a mathematician, but pretty soon discovered that was not really for me, though the mathematics I know has been incredibly useful to me in my life. But once I discovered economics, more or less someone telling me, if you want to stay here, you better study economics. It's for layabouts like you. I really did find that I had something that worked for me, and that I was really interested in what makes people tick, on what makes them better off or worse off. So there are a whole set of issues around differences between people, whether people are poor or not, and how society structures these things, that really appealed to me and have appealed to me all along. So that's how I got here, sort of idea.
Okay. And why this book at this time?
I think that's a complicated story too. As you said in the introduction, I've been writing these sort of op-ed length newsletters to the Royal Economic Society for 25 years. They were inspired by the then editor of the Royal Economic Society newsletter, who'd much loved Alistair Cook's Letters from America. And so these were sort of letters from America with an economics bent. And I discovered over the years that people really liked them. So there was a brief period before Anne Case thought of Deaths of Despair, where I was probably as famous for these newsletters as I was for anything else. And so some of them became quite well known. And so, of course, the press here, Princeton University Press, thought they'd make a good book. And they thought they could just be stapled together. That didn't work, and as I'm sure you would understand. And I spent a long summer, probably the summer of 2022, I guess, trying to put them into some sort of coherent shape. And that was a very valuable exercise because, as you said, there's a lot of new stuff there, and especially the stuff at the end where I've come to be very suspicious of the way that standard economics thinks about the world. And I've come to think that we, as economists, as a profession, especially the policy profession, bear some of the responsibility for the mess that we're in right now.
I wanted to mention, I found your new book's title and subtitle. It seemed to me very carefully chosen and provocative. Economics in America, that title seems to set out that we're taking on something quite large here. It almost sounds like the title of a large textbook rather than a slim book of essays. Why economics in America?
Well, there were many other titles
I bet.
as we worked along. I mean, one of my working titles for a long time was Shock and Awe, though I think that's perhaps been overused. But it was partly, and this is runs through the book. You know, when I first came here, as a foreigner, as a wee lad from Scotland, you might say, I was awed by the immense achievements of economics in America and of America itself. You know, everything's big, everything's splendid, and especially in economics, the great economists that I'd grown up with were largely here. Not all of them, but you know, this was the place where it was really happening. And shock was, of course, there's a lot of things here that are sort of appalling to an
Yes,
outsider, you know,
yeah.
the healthcare system being one of them, the focus on race, which of course exists in Britain, but nothing like the same way. And so there's a very dark side of the place too. And I think much of the book is actually about the profession and about how the profession handles itself in the modern world and in America. So it's really almost the economics profession in America. And then, you know, the immigrant title.
Well, I was going to say, and the subtitle, An Immigrant Economist Explores the Land of Inequality. First part of that, to include that in the subtitle is to, you know, headline something. How has your status as an immigrant, do you think, influenced your work and your ideas?
Well, I just come from a different place. And so, yeah, I first spent studied economics at the University of Cambridge in England. And, you know, the furthest right economist I'd ever met was a Fabian socialist. I didn't know there was anything beyond that. And in fact, quite a few of my friends use the term Fabian socialist as an insult, because the dominant theme in Cambridge in those days was Trotskyists, you know. So I came to America with a different set of baggage
Very,
than,
very, I'd say.
most
And oh,
people would
and remind
have.
us again, Angus, the year you moved here, just so people have that in there.
I moved here in 1983,
In 83. Okay, very
or at
good.
least I came in 1979 for a year to see how I liked it, as it were. And then in 1983, I came back for good. And I came back to Princeton, and I've been here ever since, though we've toyed with the idea of moving from time to time. So Princeton's been a, it's not, it's a little bit detached. It's not far from Washington and New York. It's not Boston or Cambridge with a very, what often seems to an outsider, very much ingrown set of people who see each other all the time. So Princeton is some distance, and I've liked it. And also, Princeton has a lot of money, and I came from a British system that didn't have any at all. But the earlier years when I was at Cambridge, I was a junior, very junior research assistant from 1969 through to 1976. And during that time, the Keynesians were still there. Joan Robinson, her ex-husband, Austin Robinson, Lord Kahn, the people who'd worked with Keynes on the general theory were very much the sort of dominant intellectual force then. And, that's a very, very different perspective from what you would get from going to an American graduate school, for instance.
Unless you'd gone in the 50s, maybe, or the early 60s.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that could be. That
Yeah.
could be. But I don't think even, in the days of high Keynesianism in
Yeah.
Cambridge
Yeah.
Harvard after the war, it was quite as left-leaning as Cambridge, England would have been then.
Yeah. Yeah. I can remember as a freshman in college for me, which would have been 1966, at Harvard interviewing John Kenneth Galbraith.
Right.
And he was certainly a leading figure, at least. Now, what's interesting is, at least to me, right? I'm looking at, I didn't realize then how much influence Chicago had, and Friedman and that ilk. I just don't think I saw that. So, but I wanted to say another thing. You describe America in that subtitle. Again, I'm picking the subtitle. Not as the land of the free, the home of the brave, or even as the richest, most powerful nation on earth, but as the land of inequality. I feel like that really puts a stake in the ground. Can you talk about, you know what
Yeah.
I'm saying?
No, I know what you're saying, but it goes with those other things. I mean,
Yeah.
opportunity comes with inequality. And the libertarianism and the freedom and the land of the brave, there are people who don't succeed in the land of the brave, and that's sort of the price you pay. So that this is not just an incidental observation by a foreigner who comes in and looks at this. It's sort of the nature of the place in some sense.
Yeah. I recently spoke with Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway about their book, The Big Myth. And one of the points they make, because I heard it in kind of implicit in what you were just saying, is that one of the achievements of the right was to, and this is in some sense the big myth they're talking about, was to link freedom, economic freedom with political freedom, so that libertarianism it became interwoven in their narratives with, with being an American and being free. Your thoughts about that?
I think so, but it's not just them. I mean, it goes back a long way, and it's the great strength of libertarianism that it focuses on human freedom. But I mean, that was true for Hayek. It was true for Lionel Robbins in London, sort of before those guys got started in some sense. And Friedman was just a very junior figure when
Yeah.
Hayek was starting the Monpperlin Society, for example. So that's an old idea. There's a quote of Keynes I used towards the end of the book, which I didn't know until quite recently, which is, and I may get this garbled, he says there's three things that we have to deal with One is efficiency, economic efficiency. The other is social justice. And the third one is individual freedom. And the economics and politics is actually about reconciling those three things. And it's not easy. And, you know, in some sense, Chicago economics reconciles the first and the last, because it's about economic efficiency and about individual freedom. And it's brought those two things together. But, you know, other people did that too. Nozick, for instance, you know, in philosophy, you know, who was opposed to taxes, for instance, and thought of taxes as theft. So these ideas are pretty powerful and they're there all along. But it's true that Chicago somehow got a very dominant position, partly through Milton Friedman's amazing talents as a debater and a proselytizer.
Yeah. When I look at the story, and I've mentioned this often in previous episodes and so on, of how we got here, the far end of this line being the deaths of despair, but along the road, both in terms of the breadth and the length of time, this growing inequality and growing dominance of the very wealthy and the very powerful, and marginalization of more and more of the regular Americans. I often start in 1970 with Milton Friedman's op-ed about enriching the shareholder being the only purpose of business, or the certainly primary, but perhaps sole, and Lewis Powell's memo. Lewis Powell, who later became Supreme Court Justice, but the Powell memo, which looked at things like a Nixon-signed EPA and Nixon-signed OSHA, and said, business, guys, because of course back then it was mostly guys, there's a whole bigger role we've got to start playing. We've been taking it too easy, you know, whether it's the business roundtable or the conversion of the Chamber of Commerce, et cetera, et cetera. And what Oreskes and Conway do actually is they say, but this mythologizing goes back at least to the start of the 20th century. And I will just share with you that the day I interviewed them, they start their book with a bit about how business even defended child labor back in the early 1900s. And that day, one of the headlines in the paper was about the resurgence of child labor. From those two things, it seems to me, the course changed. That course we were on coming out of the Depression and World War II, which I think was maybe the high point in America of we're all in this together, unless you're black, and began that route to where you're in this for yourself and you know, good luck.
Yeah, I think 1970 is an important hinge for many, many things. And, you know, that was the heyday of the blue-collar aristocrats. Mm. You know, people who could build themselves a really good life, much better than their parents had ever known, while working in a steelworks or working in a car plant or something. The business story, I think, goes much further back. I mean, the business has opposed laws against child labor since the beginning of the 19th century, never mind, you know, the 20th century. But I agree with the importance of the Powell memo and that being part of the hinge thing. In some ways, the Chicago Doctrine was an apologia for that rather than its root cause, I think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, businesses certainly lined up to support the Montparnasse Society and so on from a very early stage. But I wanted to make a somewhat different split here. So one of the inequality, you know, I was brought up with people like Tony Atkinson and Amartya Sen. We spent a lot of time thinking about income inequality and how to deal with it, and earnings inequality and wage inequality, very much an issue in Britain then as now. But what I've come to see as, I think, really, really important, and it's so important today, is this educational divide. Mm-hmm. And particularly between people who've got a four-year college degree in America and those who do not, with one group continuing to make progress and the other one not at all. And in some ways, that switch, the decline of the less educated Americans, the workers, begins around that date you're talking about, which is 1970. You know, which is a hinge point in lots of ways in American history. But I wanted to go back to this life expectancy. We did not actually show that life expectancy was falling, and it wasn't when we wrote. What we showed was that mortality in middle age among white non-Hispanics was rising. You know, it takes more than that to tip around life expectancy. And it was only a year or two later after we first wrote, this is after our first paper, not really after the book, when the CDC discovered that life expectancy was falling. But the big thing here, the big divide, and this is the craziest thing, I still find it rather hard to believe, that life expectancy for all Americans taken together, men and women, blacks, whites, Hispanics, and everything, has been falling since 2010 for those who do not have a four-year college degree. Whereas for those with a four-year college degree, it's gone on rising up until the pandemic at least. And then during the pandemic, the hit for the people with a college degree was much smaller than the hit for the people who didn't have a college degree, because, you know, we all sat at home doing the sort of thing you and I are doing right now. Whereas those people were out there in meatpacking plants and grocery stores and driving buses and things, and you know, it really showed up. So that divide, which I think is important over the whole of, you know, not just life expectancy, but in terms of earnings, in terms of wealth, it used to be half of all wealth in 1990 was owned by people who didn't have a four-year degree. Now it's 20%. Of wealth is owned by people who don't have a BA. Now, some of that in a per capita, that's not quite as bad, but still, that's been a big change. Blacks and whites, this huge racial gaps in life expectancy, which are still there, have closed a lot between blacks and whites, but opened up within blacks between those with and without a four-year degree. The same as this happening for whites. So, and you know, this is what I come to at the end of the book, I think, which is that this government by elites, which was so characteristic of the Clinton and Obama years, has been sort of a disaster because it's not listening to the ordinary people who often have very different views. And in a democracy, you can't just deprive people of their right to participate because they don't have a four-year college degree.
And even more so in a country with an electoral college,
Absolutely.
right? In other
We're
words,
reaping the whirlwind of that particular failure, right?
yes, yeah. In other
It's
words,
completely
if you counted,
insane.
if you could count all of California's votes, if you know what I mean, there would have been no Trump presidency, and
Well, the
probably,
popular vote would do
yeah, exactly.
But I'm not defending that. I mean,
No,
you
it's the
know, the electoral,
combination. It's the
it's a
synergy.
co Yeah, because we can't, you know, this educated elite, people like me, are going around saying, if you think that, you don't deserve to have any role in running the country, sort of idea. And we've despised people on what they think about immigration. We've despised people on what they think about trade. And, you know, the economic consensus on all these issues is not nearly as solid as we like to pretend it is.
I also think that as campaigns became more and more expensive, the funding of those campaigns with a Clinton or an Obama, they turned to Wall Street, so that they were getting their funds from the same people the Republicans were, yet at least giving lip service to the fact that they had different plans and different ideals. And and whereas in my earliest years as an adult, the unions were primary to the Democratic political success. And as the unions decreased and the costs expanded, I found the Democrats straddling unsuccessfully what their espoused beliefs and their funding.
That's right. And it's actually not so much straddling. I mean, when they were in power, they acted like the Party of Wall Street.
Yes, yes. I appreciated George Packer's four narratives in The Last Best Hope. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yes, I know that book.
And that Smart America description of the Clinton, although Clinton is the one that said the era of big government is over and did welfare reform and some terrible deregulation of media and so on. The way that Obama responded to the crash of 08 actually probably had even more effect on people. But both of them, basically, you are right. They basically presided from Wall Street.
Right. And the secretaries of Treasury were either Wall Street or, you know, Amon Rubin and Summers.
Yeah.
Is an academic,
strong
Wall Street links and the Geithner. It's very much governing as if you were Wall Street.
Yeah.
And I think Biden's trying to do something about that for the first time in a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think, you know, late in November, I don't know how we're all going to feel, but I think had this administration been able to remain focused on domestic policy, or at least people's attention here focused on domestic policy, I think there was a wave in their direction. I think foreign policy, which is usually ignored by Americans, but not when it is something as big as Russia's invasion of Ukraine or the Israeli-Gaza situation, I fear that. But let me go back just to your deaths of despair stuff, in that one of the things that I think is just an interesting quirk is that you looked at death certificates and it was right at 1990 that they began to list education.
Yes.
And just tell a little bit about how that played a role in your work.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the CDC publishes, or the National Vital Statistical Service, publishes these numbers on death. So there's a wonderful website called CDC Wonder, where you can analyze almost every aspect of who's dying of what and what's happening to this over time and all that good stuff. And it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. But you can't split up things by education. It's just not in the official statistics. And I think that's because, you know, there's a lot of inertia. They do things the way they've always done it. And it's only since 1990 or a little earlier for some states that they started recording the educational status on the death certificates. The US is one of the few countries that does that. Britain doesn't even include race on the death certificates. So they don't really have very good statistics on differential mortality by race, which has been a source of a lot of trouble. But the US does do that. And so it has all these accounts by race. And we built the ones by education. We're not the first people to do that. But, you know, you have to download the 80 million death certificates or whatever it is and count them up one at a time. And that nowadays is sort of something you can do on your laptop, but didn't used to be.
Right, right. And so this quirk that they begin to identify it, and as you look, you can only go back that far, you know, to link death certificates to education. But the trends that we've been talking about of the
right,
this continuity between the break in society that really happens over college education,
right?
Yeah,
and you know, and that's happening. It even happening in incarceration, where you know, race is becoming less important, and you know, education becoming more important. So it's this whole societal split. And the Democrats at the same time have become the sort of party of the educated elite and minorities, though they're beginning to lose the minorities.
Yeah.
And Republicans have become this bizarre half populist, half business party. You know, and I don't know how long they'll be able to sustain that split.
Yeah. I mean, fanning the flames of grievance is a good electoral strategy. But then once you get into office, I think Trump might act on the worst of those grievances, but probably a whatever we would have called a previous Republican would not have, even if they helped them get elected. Let me tell people that this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Nobel Prize-winning economist Angus Deaton. He's co-author of Death of Despair and the Future of Capitalism, and author most recently of Economics in America, An Immigrant Economist Explores the Land of Inequality. And you can learn more at Deaton, D-E-A-T-O-N, deaton.scholar.princeton.edu. Let's talk about healthcare, because I think we've laid out that the big divide here seems to be that America is now, a good place to live if you have a college education, and a much tougher place to live if you don't. But what's the role of healthcare? And let me just point out one thing. Back when universal healthcare and Obamacare and even under Clinton, I focused more on that. But one thing that was a quirk that separates us from Europe is the linkage of healthcare with jobs. And one thing that I learned was that emerged as a way to get around price and wage controls during World War II. There was a limited labor market because so many people were in the service, and you had to attract workers, and there were wage and price controls in effect. So some people got smart and said, oh, we'll offer health care. And that thing that at that point was a strategy just to deal with a specific situation, now I think leaves us in this horrible situation. Talk about the role of healthcare in America versus healthcare in other advanced countries.
Well, what you said about health insurance during the war is true. But you have to also ask the question as to why didn't we get rid of it after that?
Exactly. No, that's of course.
And you know, that other countries, you know, Britain was building its welfare state in the immediate post-war years, including a nationalized healthcare system, which was founded in those years. Truman got pretty close, and it was actively debated in this country in those years. And what ultimately blocked it was our old bugbear of race.
I was just going to, the next question I was looking at, what's the role of race in all of this? Go ahead.
So, you know, the Southern Democrats were not going to have any part of it, and there was no willingness by them or by maybe a larger section of white people to pay for health care for black people. So, you know, that blockage, which doesn't really exist in other countries in the same way, was largely responsible. There were other things too, and there's some good histories of this. And remember, it's not largely paid for by workers. I mean, most of us don't get sick until we're old, and we're covered then by Medicare. And many people are covered by Medicaid. So the government is actually the largest payer for health care. But most working age people who have health insurance get it through their employers. So that's exactly right.
But as you point out, one of the effects of that is that it eats up a lot of their wages, that the guy in
absolutely.
The C-suite with a much bigger salary, his company pays for his health care, but the guy on the line or at the cashier, that it eats up a huge part of their what would have been wage gains.
Well, that's right. But remember that the guys on the line are also getting some coverage from their employer, but some of it comes out of the wages. And that would be true for the CEO too. But the crucial thing here is that there's not that much difference in insuring the cost of health insurance for the CEO as there is for his chauffeur, because you're basically insuring an otherwise healthy body. And, you know, a body is a body, and it doesn't much matter how much that body is earning. You're not trying to insure their salary. You're insuring the cost of health care. And so the cost of health care, you know, which is something like $11,000 a year per person, is trivial if you're earning $300,000. But it's not trivial if you're on a minimum wage job as a security guard or a janitor or a food service worker. So what that's meant is that people just get rid of those jobs, and they contract them out. They bring in cleaning services or food services or security guard services. And most large employers don't have those jobs anymore. And those used to be good jobs. They might not have been CEO type jobs, but you were working for a big company, you were part of a large enterprise and all the rest of it. And then you get kicked out and replaced by someone who comes in from an agency. And many of those agencies have the reputation of hiring illegal aliens and all the rest of it. So, you know, what I suppose I'm supposed to call undocumented aliens. So, you know, that is a running sore, and it's costing people an enormous amount of jobs. I mean, one executive we talked to said that his personnel people came in one year and said, "Hi guys, your health insurance bills are going up by 40% next year." And the executives looked at each other and said, "We can't do that. You know, we can't exist if we have to pay 40% more than that." And so, you know, they call in McKinsey and basically yep. they reduce the headcount. They get rid of all these people, and they get rid of the people at the bottom, the less skilled workers, because they're the ones who are costing a lot in healthcare relative to what they're worth to the company and the CEOs and all the rest of it.
If we go back to the three things that we're trying to balance, efficiency, social justice, and freedom, they make their choices to improve efficiency, and they assert their freedom to do so, and social justice be damned.
Of course, it's not just that. The problem that we haven't talked about yet, but it boils all this up, is just it costs such an incredible amount of money. So, you know, we're spending nearly 18% of GDP on this, and the next highest is Switzerland, which is 12% of GDP. And so, you know, if we could reduce it to the Swiss cost, and the Swiss live 5 years longer than Americans, we wouldn't have a problem anymore. Because it would be, you know, only, 60% of the cost. And that would relieve most of the problem. And of course, because the feds are paying so much of this, almost all the biggest driver of government deficits in Washington is healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just screwing us every which way. And, you know, that in some sense takes us back to Chicago, I think, because any attempt to, this is not a free market system. I mean, people like to call it a free market system, but as soon as they use it, the free market libertarianism in Chicago, as a rod to beat anyone who suggests that you should have price control. And of course, this whole system is deeply compromised. I mean, it's not a free market healthcare system.
Right. I think that on the one hand, yes, we can rail, as I might certainly, against the libertarian side of economics and so on. But it's I found interesting Rebecca Henderson, who's at the Harvard Business School, and Branko Milanovic both raised the same point when I was talking to them. They both said capitalism is okay. The problem is when it writes its own rules.
Right.
And
so that's exactly what I'm trying to say here. And libertarianism is called in to sort of defend the system, whereas it's not really at all. It's defending a system that's written its own rules.
That's right.
And, you know, there's six healthcare lobbyists in Washington for every member of Congress, and no unions anymore. How do you think that's going to work out?
Yeah. Yeah. What I sort of want to ask, because I realize time is flying, key concepts in economics are incentives and risks. And it seems to me that America has its incentives all wrong. Can you talk a bit about how you see that?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, I think of efficiency as being a more central concept than, incentives are obviously important. But
well, as a tool, not as a goal, but as a tool.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I'm on the same page here.
Okay.
So elaborate a little more.
Well, we've been talking about there was an incentive to fire all those people and bring in contract
right.
workers because
right.
of, and there's an incentive to hide political contributions, and there's, you know, all these things, and as you know, as was has been shown, is that what the wealthy want is what usually happens ultimately, that the common people in this democracy get what they want when it goes along with what the wealthy want.
That's right. And in fact, it's worse than that, because the people who've done that work, you know, they look at votes that come up, whereas a lot of the stuff that people really care about never gets on the table, you know, because the lobbying is so extensive and so on. So a lot of what you're talking about is campaign finance, I think.
Yeah.
And that's a big difference between the U.S. and most other countries. So these, you know, legislatures are beholden to money. And, you know, that bakes it in. And if you have this extreme wealth inequality and all this campaign finance, and it's not corruption in the sense that individual legislatures mm-hmm. are bought. It's that you don't ever get the chance to run unless you're someone who's sympathetic to those positions to start with. And we've lost the countervailing power that we used to have from unions.
That's right.
Which was a very important thing in those days, and it's just not there anymore. But in terms of incentives, it's true that a lot of the prices, the way one might put this is, you're taught in Economics 101 that prices reflect social costs. And so when people get these signals, the price signals, the price indicates to someone who's thinking of buying something or producing something how much it's worth to society. But when you get all this monopsony and monopoly and regulations and all the rest of it on top of it, the prices don't indicate that at all. And so people have the wrong incentives. And in some ways, if I were a thoroughgoing libertarian, which I'm not, you know, we might have a better world than we did right now. So going back to what you said, Branko, and Rebecca Henderson had said, I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, two questions that come right out of that. And I'll throw them both out there and you can take them in order. One is, it seems that even the ones who have their thumbs on the scale, whether it's through campaign finance or lobbying, writing its own rules and so on, it seems to me they can even see that the feedback loops are taking the whole country in a really bad direction. So even if they aren't, you know, wonderfully compassionate social justice folks, it seems like you'd say, let's moderate ourselves a little bit. Why does it seem that it's so relentlessly going in the wrong direction? And the second half of that is, why can't America learn from other countries?
Well, the first one is something to do with collective action. You may despise the system, and I'm sure you could find really good people in Google or in Apple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, but their individual incentives are to put their lobbyists in Washington and get the rules changed in their behalf, right? They may think that if we had a world in which none of this was allowed, that would be a better world. And that is a lot more like Europe or a lot more like Britain. You know, I remember talking to Gus O'Donnell, now Lord O'Donnell, who was the head of the civil service in Britain for a long time, and asking him, you know, how difficult would it be for a company to get, and how long would it take to get a law changed in its favor? And he looked at me with horror, and, you know, he was no innocent. You know, he'd been running the country for a long time. And he said, that could never happen. And now, of course, I think now he might have a slightly different story. Mm-hmm. But it's just, that's not the bread and butter of British politics, by and large. Mm-hmm. Because people don't need huge sums of money to run. The parties don't need anything like that amount of money. And in Europe, because so much of the legislation is written at the European level, it's much harder for firms to influence Europe than it would be for British firms to influence Britain or French firms to influence mm-hmm. France. And some have argued, like my friend Thomas Philippon has argued, that that's one of the reasons that prices have risen so much more rapidly in the US than they have in the European Union, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a collective action problem. It's like something I was just reading today about social media. You could make an argument that says everybody on social media would be happy if social media were closed down. But, you know, they don't want to do that individually unless all their friends agree to do it too. And so you can't get that to happen. So I've forgotten what the other half.
Well, it has struck me for God as long as I've been looking at it. America, which sort of tells itself that it is the can-do country, it seems like when you had a problem, you would look, how do other folks solve it, and can we do better than that? And yet America seems unable to learn from the successes of other countries.
Well, I think one of the things that would take you a long way is, you know, abolishing money in politics. And what is it? Your First Amendment? Our First Amendment that says you can't do that. And the courts have interpreted it.
Well, at least as the courts interpret it, yes.
Yeah, as the courts interpret it. And that is a huge difference because, you know, if you've got all these six healthcare lobbyists wandering around on Capitol Hill, how are you going to get the price of healthcare down? You're not. And occasionally they get beaten off, as they did with the Medicare drug negotiation. But mostly they win almost everything. And it's very hard to stop that. And I don't know how, you know, you could learn from other countries by saying other countries don't let this happen.
Well, Angus, as I look at labor, right? Germany has for years had a policy where the unions or the workers have roles on the board.
Yep.
When American unions during certain tougher times were giving up things and allowing two tiers and, you know, all of this and to help their, they didn't even say, but wait, here's what we want in exchange. We want a couple of roles on the board. I'm saying even progressives in America don't seem to know how other systems work.
It's interesting that, I mean, the German got that system as a gift from the British at the end of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And the British never reformed their own system, which, of course, was reformed only when Margaret Thatcher broke it, essentially. But I don't know enough about the history of unionism in the U.S., but there's been a lot of corruption, a lot of unions where they lined their own pockets instead of helping their workers. And that seems to be the story with the recent events with the auto workers, for instance, that you've got a leadership now who simply says, look, we've given too much over too many years. And I think most of us thought, well, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. Let's hope they're right. And it turns out they were right, because it was amazing how much the companies gave up.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So if the companies had been doing what they said and said, we can't put prices up because of foreign companies, all that sort of thing, you know, and this is the way the world is, turned out they couldn't possibly have afforded that, and yet they did.
Yeah.
So there's a real sense in which, and I'm hopeful on that, because I think, even though I grew up in Britain, where many of us found the unions incredibly annoying, and, you know, there were strikes all the time, and bodies didn't get buried, all that sort of stuff. But, you know, working people need to have some power. And if they don't have it, you get what we've got now, you know, and taking that power away from them, however convenient it may be for those of us who want to live without that nuisance, has brought a terrible price with it.
And
that price might be Donald Trump.
Yeah, it might be a second term of Donald Trump.
Yes.
Yeah. What questions are driving you these days? What haunts you or excites you?
Well, I think I would like to see economics be much broader than it is. So part of my work with Anne on mortality is like saying, I get driven nuts when people say America is this incredibly successful society. We're booming and all the other countries in the world are doing badly. And yet there are bodies all over the streets. Enormous numbers of people dying from drug overdoses, from suicide and so on. And so I'm not saying that doesn't mean the other things aren't true. It's just that if you want a broader picture, you have to bring those things into account. And health is a very easy thing to measure, at least in terms of mortality, because you can tell whether people are dead or alive.
Right.
And, you know, I get very tired of like this huge debate that's going on. Did inequality go up? Did inequality not go up? And there are endless measurement errors and measurement issues in there, whereas we actually know whether people are alive or dead or not. So that seems to me a powerful tool for exposing the narrowness of economics to make people think about this. And then I think we've been much too individualistic in our approach that, you know, community, there's things that matter to people other than just the consumption that they buy, like their friendships, their marriages, their communities, a lot of stuff that we're not very good at thinking about. And it's sort of like economists say free trade is good for you. And that means that on average,
yes, in the macro,
consume more. Yeah,
we don't live in the macro, each of us.
That's right. I mean, you say, well, who benefited from it? They say, well, consumers benefited from it because they can go to Target and buy cheap Chinese goods. But, you know, who's benefited? They say, well, the country benefits. Well, the country's that is garbage, right? There's
yeah.
no such thing, you know? So I think we've been very bad at doing that.
You're saying we as
Me too.
A country,
Me too.
But you're also saying we as an economics
yes.
profession and as a field.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And
you
I get a lot of pushback on this.
You get pushback from other economists who say, stay in your lane?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Larry Summers got really mad at me, and we had this long, bitter debate on YouTube, which you can look at if you want to be not amused for an hour and a quarter.
Listen, I've been not amused by Larry Summers many times. One more time.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just getting him to see that there's downsides to a lot of these policies, like, you know, having the all-volunteer military. So all of our enlisted people in the military are Trump supporters. Well, that doesn't seem like a very good idea.
Yeah, yeah. No, it just goes on and on. You know, a book you may or may not know, but I found myself thinking about, and it goes back several years, maybe the early 2000s. Bill McKibben wrote a book called Deep Economy.
Oh, I haven't read that.
And what he started from was the annual survey on happiness in America. And there yeah. is one, you know. And it turned out that Americans were happier in the 50s. And
I'm not sure I believe that. But anyway,
yeah,
I've done some work on that. Yeah.
That's the survey, right? And it's
yeah.
it's they it comes out every year, and I mean I'd heard about it before this, but what he felt was that the loss of community outweighed all the gains in efficiency and technology and all of that, and it seems that's very much what you
yeah.
feel as well.
I do feel that, though I have written some papers on happiness. I'm a bit skeptical about using happiness as the measure of that. But yes, I do believe that. You know, and for instance, just to give you an example, in these happiness surveys, black people are way happier than white people in the U.S. And does that mean we don't really have a problem and
oh,
we should all
yeah.
try to be like black people? You know, there are things like that which
yeah.
have to give you some pause.
Yeah.
But I'm I will look for that book, and I'm sympathetic with that idea that, you know, the loss of community. Raghuram Rajan has a book, too, called The Third Pillar, mm. which is about the loss of community. And the sort of argument that that's something we've been doing very badly on.
Yeah, and it seems like it's not something, you know, he calls it the third pillar. Bill, you know, thought it was crucial. It's not something that I think people talk about enough. They will talk about the deaths at the far end, and they'll talk about the loneliest century or whatever it's called,
right.
you know, what people say right now. That sort of is like the headline, but I don't think people talk enough about just the day-to-day loss to screens as well as to everything else. Final question. Angus Deaton, you're standing in the future. 10, 15, 25 years have passed, and you're looking back. Did we turn things around? And if so, what were some of the ways it happened?
Oh, I wish I could give you an optimistic answer for that. I think about it quite a lot. I mean, I think we are sort of standing on the edge of a precipice. And the optimist would say, is this really worse than 1933, for instance? Mm-hmm. Is it really worse than 1880? I mean, you can take all these places in history where things looked really bad. I'm pretty optimistic because I think that we've confronted very bad problems before and we have a very deep desire to make things better. And that's a very powerful force. But I'm more skeptical now than I've been for a really long time.
Oh. Yeah.
But, you know, your podcast says you're going to fix things. So what do you think?
Well, that's but you'll notice when I first named it, and I would say a world that just might work, and they'd say, how about just a world that works for everyone? And I said, I'm not that optimistic. You know, right. It might, but the subjunctive is essential there. And without, you know, without an awful lot from an awful lot of people, individually and collectively, it won't. And we didn't even talk about climate, and
no,
we didn't
talk
much about race, and we didn't talk much about the energy of one of the political parties in this country seems to be to just fan grievance and anger and rage and separation. Those three things I try to think that's why I asked that question. It's like, what's going to change? What's going to change?
Well, here's one thing that I'm quite positive about, and I thought it would never happen. I'm retired, so I don't go into the university as often as I did. But when I talk to friends and other people, and here we're having this conversation today, so I'm talking to you, and you're along these lines too, which is we're beginning to think that we, the educated elite, you know, actually share some responsibility for what's happened. And I was in an event the other day which was about climate change, and someone in the audience said to me, how do you talk to these people? You know, meaning Trump voters. And my major reaction is we should be listening to them, not talking to them. And I think that's really, really important. And it's not that you want to buy everything they say, but you want to listen to the real grievances they have and accept the possibility that we might have been wrong in spite of all of our education and our theories and so on. And I think on a lot of these things we were wrong.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to find a quote here that I have in my notes. Within days of Trump's election, I happened to come across this quote. And it's from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, the author of The Little Prince.
Indeed.
And he said, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea.
Right.
And it seems that we need, to rally people that we're here now, and the things we do today will help decide where we are tomorrow and where our children are, and there's possibility we could do this, and just, you know, create a vision that makes yearning for a future better than yearning for the past.
And we need a common purpose to do that, and that common good, that common purpose is in pretty short supply these days.
Yeah.
But I'm seeing signs that maybe it will be rebuilt.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much, Angus. One thing I must say is that what I hear in your voice, and I speak to, you know, people like this, is a thoughtfulness, a sort of there's a little. It's not doubt, but as you sort of said, that we might be responsible. And there's I don't hear you with rapid fire, short, you know, answers. I hear someone who's wrestling.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I made a lot of mistakes in my life. And, it's good to be able to live long enough to be able to acknowledge them.
Yeah. Again, the new book is Economics in America, An Immigrant Economist Explores the Land of Inequality. And you can learn more about Angus Deaton's work at deaton.scholar.princeton.edu. Deaton, D-E-A-T-O-N, terrenceterrence.scholar.princeton.edu. For this conversation, many other interviews and articles to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're both the same website, and they're both one word, terrenceemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 articles to flesh out that conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Free Forum podcast on Apple Podcasts and most major podcast sites. And you'll find years of podcasts at those sites or at my site. Archives, Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Angus Deaton, and keep up your good work.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Very well.
Well done.